Well, let's get started. Thank you for coming. I know that it's not ideal to have to wear masks again inside. I was told that teachers could speak without masks, which is helpful because it's really muffled to try. Oh, I should try to turn this on. There we go. And I know it's much more attractive to be outside without masks on and hiking and stuff, so I appreciate you coming this morning. We're going to begin with a psalm again for our prayer. This is one of my... I'll do the last part of this psalm, Psalm 96, because it's somewhat lengthy, but... it's a psalm about creation's praise of God. Say among the nations, the Lord is king. The world is firmly established, it shall never be moved. He will judge the peoples with equity. Let the heavens be glad and let the earth rejoice. Let the sea roar and all that fills it. Let the field exult and everything in it. Then shall all the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord, for he is coming, to judge the earth. He will judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with his truth. Amen. It seems odd to us, perhaps, that the Lord coming in judgment is reason to break into the Hallelujah chorus. Because for us, Judgment Day has some negative connotations, but here, you know, the sea roars, the heavens are glad, the fields exult, and the trees of the forest sing for joy before the Lord, for he is coming to judge the earth. For the trees and the fields and the oceans and all that inhabits them, it's actually good news that God is coming in judgment, because the prophets tell us that our sin, that human sin, corrupts the earth, and so the Lord coming in judgment is a time for God to wipe away that sin, and for creation to give full voice to praise of God. And we know, not just from Scripture, but from our own experience, that human activity has dimmed the ability of creation to praise God, which it is designed to do. So the Lord coming in judgment is good news for creation and for us. So I'll review just a little bit what I did before, for those of you who weren't able to come before. We've been talking about Sabbath, and we've been talking about Sabbath in various biblical texts. So we started with the Genesis text, with the creation text, particularly Genesis 1, of course, because it's the seventh day that God sanctifies the Sabbath in Genesis 1, continuing into chapter 2. But we also talked about some text from Genesis 2, from the second creation account, where God creates Adam from the Adamah, or humans from the humus, right? We are created from the soil, from the fertile soil. And I should have mentioned, we also return to that fertile soil. So remember, after the fall, God says to Adam and Eve, "You are dust, and to dust you shall return." So we are of the soil, we come from the soil, we return to the soil. And at the same time, we are also created in the image of God. So there's a rich kind of anthropology there, right? That we are both of the earth and created in the image of God, both at the same time. Then we got into the Exodus text. So let me remind you of that. Exodus 20, of course, is the first statement of the Ten Commandments, given again to recently freed slaves. So they've come out of Egypt, they've seen the mighty hand of God working salvation to free them from slavery in Egypt. And then they're given commandments, including this one, which is kind of the hinge commandment between those that have to do with God, with our relationship with God, and the commandments that have to do with our relationship with our neighbors. So this is kind of the commandment that hinges those two parts of the law. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. You shall not do any work. You, your son or your daughter, your male or female slave, your livestock, or the alien resident in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, but rested the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it. So the giving of the Sabbath commandment in Exodus refers back to that story of creation, right? God rests on the seventh day. Because we are created in the image of God, we also are commanded to rest. And it seems a little odd, perhaps, to us that we're commanded to rest, or that people have to be commanded to rest. I love this piece by Dan Erlander in the Wilderness School, right? The Israelites are sitting there in the midst of the wilderness between Egypt and the Promised Land. Today's lesson, living as free people. And the little groundhogs or whatever say they have to be taught how to live? Well, they're only human, says the other one. And I told you this, this insight, or this lovely way of talking about this, from a pastor I know, who said, at the Red Sea, God takes the people out of Egypt. And at Sinai, God takes Egypt out of the people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's just a really lovely kind of shorthand way of talking about what the giving of the law is, right? It's a way, it's not an oppressive kind of system to former slaves, right? It's a way to teach these former slaves how to live, right? What do we do now? How do we become the people of God? Immediately before the Ten Commandments, I should have mentioned this earlier, immediately before the Ten Commandments in Exodus 19, God says to the Israelites, I'm going to read it just so I make sure I have it exactly. They come to Mount Sinai, and God says in chapter 19 of Exodus, "Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the Israelites, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession out of all the peoples. Indeed, the whole earth is mine, but you shall be for me a priestly kingdom and a holy nation." So God establishes this covenant with the Israelites in Exodus 19, and then Exodus 20 becomes instructions for how to live out that relationship, right? How to live out that relationship. In Lutheran terms, God gives them the gospel first and then the law. The gospel is, you are my people, you are my treasured possession. I will be your God and you will be my people. And then the law is, how do you live that up? How do you live that up? So, going to the wilderness school, taking Egypt out of the people. I mentioned too how this is relevant, not just for formerly freed slaves, but for us in our 24/7 world. And I told you a bit about this New York Times article about this this company called WeWork, which has been in the news for negative reasons more recently. But it's a co-working space, right, in large urban areas. And this article in the New York Times said that it has neon signs that say things like, "Hustle harder," and "Thank God it's Monday." And the cucumbers in the water cooler that are inscribed with the message, "Don't stop when you're tired, stop when you're done." So it's this kind of frenetic obsession with work, this 24/7, or this inability, really, and we're not former slaves, right? But we become enslaved to the attitude that is so prevalent in our culture today that you have to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you have to work hard, you have to work all the time. And people like Elon Musk, of course, perpetuate this kind of work culture when he tweeted, that nobody ever changed the world on 40 hours a week. You have to work 80 hours or even sometimes 100 hours a week in order to change the world. Now, the problem, of course, is that human beings are not machines, and when we pretend that we're machines, when we don't recognize the limits of our own bodies, we break down physically, mentally, emotionally, and certainly in our relationships. No one can sustain a good family life if they're working 80 hours a week. So such an obsession with work, such a modern obsession with work, egged on by those super rich folks at the top of the economic ladder, reminds me of nothing so much as the industrial economy that was ancient Egypt. Egypt, with its centralized government that controlled all the land and consumed human labor to build its monumental architecture and its storage cities, Egypt was the ancient equivalent of our society, particularly of our industrial, military-industrial complex and our consumer culture. Now, in the book of Exodus, there are two great building projects, all right? The first great building project is right at the beginning of Exodus, where it talks about Pharaoh building these storage cities. Here it is. He enslaves the Hebrews. He says, therefore they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians became ruthless in imposing tasks on the Israelites and made their lives bitter with hard service in mortar and brick and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. So think about what Egypt is known for, right? Even today, people travel to Egypt to see what? To see the pyramids, right? To see the Sphinx, to see this other marvelous and amazing works of monumental architecture. But think about the human labor, the human blood, the human sweat that was necessary to build those things, especially in an age when they didn't have the, you know, backhoes and bulldozers and cranes that we have today, right? Ellen Davis writes, Egypt is the biblical archetype of the industrial society, burning, ceaseless in its demand for slave labor, consuming until it is itself consumed in the confrontation between Pharaoh and the god of the burning bush. So think about Pharaoh as kind of the, not Pharaoh, think about Egypt as kind of the original empire. And the fuel that fuels this empire is human labor and human lives. No wonder the Deuteronomist calls Egypt the iron furnace. The Deuteronomist says, but as for you, the Lord took you and brought you out of the iron furnace, out of Egypt, to be the people of his inheritance, as you now are. Isn't that an amazing phrase or description of Egypt, right? The iron furnace. What does a furnace do? Well, a furnace consumes fuel in order to create energy, to heat or to make things. So if Egypt is the iron furnace, what is its fuel? Well, it's slavery, it's slaves, it's human lives. Not literally, you know, burning bodies, but using up human lives in this endless labor, this imposed labor that the Egyptians put on the Hebrew slaves. So that's the first great building project in Exodus. The second great building project in Exodus is this, the tabernacle. So let me remind you of the tabernacle. The tabernacle is this tent of meeting that is it's the instructions occupied several chapters in Exodus. No one usually reads this part of Exodus, right? You get to the crossing of the Red Sea and the giving of the Ten Commandments, and then everything else goes by the side. But there's like 40, there's 20 more chapters in Exodus, right? And it's mostly occupied with instructions for building the tabernacle and then the actual building of the tabernacle. The tabernacle, you might consider kind of a portable Mount Sinai, right? So the people come to Mount Sinai in chapter 19. They're there for a whole year, and they're given the law. They're given the law as a gift. And then they travel for 39 more years in the wilderness. They can't always be at Mount Sinai. And so God gives instructions for building the tabernacle so that God's presence can move with them. And this is a really astounding promise God gives to the Israelites, that God will be with them, not physically exactly, but in kind of a foretaste of the incarnation, right? When the fire and the smoke settle on the tabernacle, or as it does on Mount Sinai, then they know that God's presence is with them. Or when the cloud settles on the tabernacle, they know that God is with them, traveling with them from place to place. So you might think of the tabernacle again as kind of a portable Mount Sinai. And so God gives instructions for building the tabernacle, but both before and after the instructions for building the tabernacle, God gives them again the Sabbath commandment. Therefore, the Israelites shall keep the Sabbath, observing the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign forever between me and the people of Israel, that in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, and on the seventh day he rested and was refreshed. Well, that may seem strange to us, right? Why would you give a command to rest right before you give the command to, or all the instructions for building the tabernacle? And why would you end those instructions again with a restatement of the Sabbath commandment? That may seem odd to us, especially compared to the endless work that they had to do on that first building project in Egypt. Well, it may seem odd to us that the Sabbath commandment is repeated both before and after the instructions for building the tabernacle, but it tells us that it's not just the end product that is important, but the character of the work. Right? They're not slaves any longer, so even when they're doing something good, like building the tabernacle, they do it in such a way that they have abundant life, right? That they rest periodically. In other words, made in the image of God, we are to emulate God's way of being in the world. God rested from God's work in creation. Surely we can do so too. The weight of the world does not rest on our shoulders. We are not God. Therefore, even when the work we do is good and necessary, like building the tabernacle, like being a pastor, like being a teacher, fill in the blank here, we must rest from it, rest from that work periodically, and trust that God will provide what is needed. So these two great building projects in Exodus, I think, are a good illustration of our relationship with work, right? That even when we're doing good things, Sabbath is an important thing to incorporate into our work, a regular time of rest. It's not just the end product that is important, but the character of the work. All right, I want to look at another story that Sabbath has a part of, and this has to do with manna. So, but first I have to set it up by reminding you of the people's complaining. Right, like a month after they crossed the Red Sea, they start complaining, right? The whole congregation of the Israelites complained against Moses and Aaron in the wilderness. The Israelites said to them, "If only we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt when we sat by the flesh pots and ate our fill of bread, for you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." So they don't care that they were slaves. They just want to have something to eat. They want the flesh pots of Egypt. So they complain. They complain later in Numbers as well. The rabble among them had a strong craving, and the Israelites also wept again and said, "If only we had meat to eat." I'm thinking of Holden Village. "If only we had meat to eat." I love the food here. It's just, you know.
Eat your fill of bread.
We can have our fill of bread, yes. We can have our fill of bread, right. "We remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt for nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic," the Israelites say. "And yes, probably those cucumbers, too, were engraved with the ancient equivalent of the mantra, 'Don't stop when you're tired, stop when you're done.'" So this goes on. I should have included the next verse. They say, "If only we had the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic, but all we have is this stupid manna that we've been eating for, decades now." So, lots of complaining. How does God respond? Well, God provides manna and quails. So in the evening, quails came up and covered the camp, and in the morning there was a layer of dew around the camp. When the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a fine flaky substance as fine as frost on the ground. When the Israelites saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" In Hebrew, manhu. That's where you get the term manna. Man means what. Who is just a pronoun. Manhu, what is it? For they did not know what it was. Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather as much of it as each of you needs. An omer is just a unit of measurement. I forget how many omers are to a bushel. An omer to a person according to the number of persons, all providing for those in their own tents." So the Israelites did so, some gathering more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, those who gathered much had nothing over, and those who gathered little had no shortage. They gathered as much as each of them needed. And Moses said to them, "Let no one leave any of it over until morning." But of course they do, because they want to hoard the manna, right, and then it becomes foul and gets worms in it. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much food, two omers apiece. When all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, "This is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil, and all that is left over put aside to be kept until morning." So they put it aside until morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not become foul, and there were no worms in it. Moses said, "Eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is a Sabbath, there will be none." But, of course, some of them go out on the seventh day to look for manna, and then God gets mad and says, "How long will these people refuse to keep my commandments and instructions?" And then gives the Sabbath commandment again. "Each of you stay where you are. Do not leave your place on the seventh day." So the people rested on the seventh day. Ellen Davis, my teacher and mentor that I mentioned yesterday, she writes about this in her book, Scripture, Culture, and Agriculture. She says, "In the manna economy," I like that phrase, "in the manna economy, Israel is called upon to engage in two concrete practices of restraint, namely eschewing excess," right, rejecting excess, "and keeping Sabbath. These practices might be viewed as the earnest of patience and trust in God." So two practices, not hoarding, right? You don't hoard things over until the next day, or it becomes rotten. And keeping Sabbath. You don't gather on the Sabbath because God provides enough on the day before the Sabbath. And it's interesting to see in these two practices, it says a number of times in that passage we looked at, everybody has enough, right? No one has too much, and everyone has enough. Isn't that a lovely vision of what the world should be like, right? That if people don't hoard, then everyone has enough. In this manna economy, there's no scarcity. There's enough food for everyone. What a marvelous vision of abundance. No famine, no starvation, no malnutrition, no food insecurity. And in the manna economy, neither is there hoarding. Those who hoard the manna find nothing but maggots in the morning. Everyone has enough, and no one has too much. This is the manna economy that we learn about. And it's wrapped up in Sabbath as well, right? Sabbath is about rest. Sabbath is about trust. God will provide, right? You don't have to work 7 days. God will provide. Sabbath is about rest. Sabbath is about trust. And Sabbath is about restraint, right? Don't gather more than you need. Don't take 3 pancakes when there are people waiting in line, right? I had to tell my son that this morning, right? Don't take 2 pancakes when there are people in line waiting for the pancakes, right? Don't hoard, don't make sure that everyone has enough. All right. And the marvelous gift of food is given in abundance the day before the Sabbath so that the people can gather enough for both days. So if Sabbath is about rest in Genesis 2, then Sabbath is also about trust. in Exodus 16. Trust that God will provide. Trust that everyone will have what they need. Trust that God is God and we are not. I'm reminded of a conversation I had with a farmer near Dobre, Minnesota, Luther Tostengarden. Some of you maybe who went to Luther Seminary might know that name. Luther was the first cousin and best friend of Sheldon Tostengarden, who was a longtime preaching professor at Luther Seminary. So Luther and his wife Janice, my husband Doug was their pastor, their interim pastor for a few months, a couple years ago. They have been family farmers. They grew up on a farm and then bought the family farm in 1970 and have been farming it ever since. And Luther writes this about trust and the providence of God. He said, seeing and experiencing the birth of livestock, the renewal of the earth in the spring, smelling freshly mowed alfalfa, the maturing of a crop, these are just a few examples of the beauty of God's creation. I'm grateful to see God at work as the crops germinate, grow, and mature. And this is interesting. We also see God's work as we experience hail, drought, or excessive moisture. These we do not understand, but it is good for us to see that we are not in control. Isn't that a profound statement? We are not in control. God is God and we are not. God provides, and farmers know this better than those of us who are not dependent on the weather and the soil for our livelihood. Trust is a lesson that the Israelites learned in the wilderness, and a lesson I think that farmers, amongst others, continue to teach us. One more story from Exodus, and then we'll move on to Leviticus and Deuteronomy. There's this interesting story. You probably know the story of manna. You may not know this story. So after the instructions are given for building of the tabernacle, then the tabernacle starts to be built. And Moses finds these two artisans, Bezalel and Aholiab. Moses then called Bezalel and Aholiab, and every skillful one to whom the Lord had given skill, everyone whose heart was stirred to come to do the work, that is the work of building the tabernacle. And this is not just a tent, right? There's golden utensils and there's embroidered linens in the tabernacle. And these artisans received from Moses all the freewill offerings that the Israelites had brought for doing the work on the sanctuary. They still kept bringing him freewill offerings every morning, so that all the artisans who were doing every sort of task on the sanctuary came, each from the task being performed, and said to Moses, "The people are bringing much more than enough for doing the work that the Lord has commanded us to do." So Moses gave command, and word was proclaimed throughout the camp, "No man or woman is to make anything else as an offering for the sanctuary." So the people were restrained from bringing, for what they had already brought was more than enough to do all the work. Have you ever had this problem in your stewardship campaign? Right? Stop bringing stuff. Stop giving so much money. We have more than enough. It doesn't happen all that often, but it happens here in Exodus. That Moses says, okay, we've got enough, stop. You know, you don't need to bring anything else for building the sanctuary, we have enough. We can talk about this as a kind of the same thing as the manna economy, but we might call it the economy of sufficiency. The Israelites are no longer slaves, they're not under compulsion. They share freely and generously out of what they have. In fact, they bring too much for the work of building the sanctuary. Ellen Davis, again, in this book, Scripture, Culture, and Agriculture, says, underlying the whole story is the logic of sufficiency. First, in an economy where everyone has enough, everyone can afford to be generous, and more than that, there's an impulse to be generous. Second, the influx of materials for the construction of the tabernacle reflects the essential character of God's sanctuary as a place of abundance. So, in an economy where everyone has enough, the economy of sufficiency, everyone can afford to be generous. And second, this influx of materials, this overabundance of materials reflects the idea, the theme that permeates the Old Testament of God's sanctuary as a place of abundance, right? We saw, I think, was it yesterday, talked about that vision in Ezekiel And then also in Revelation of the river of life coming from the sanctuary, coming from the temple, and bringing life wherever it flowed. So the character of God's sanctuary is that of a place of abundance. However, too much is still too much. In this economy of sufficiency where everyone has enough, restraint is also called for. You don't accumulate an excess of material goods even for good purposes. Right? So restraint is called for even in tasks and in projects where good work is being done. So an economy of sufficiency. I'm going to stop for just a minute, just to see if there's any comments or questions, because I've been talking for quite a while, and we're about halfway through.
Would you say that hoarding and that kind of, and even excess work or striving to work all the time is a form of idolatry then?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's a good, if you haven't heard, he said, is hoarding a kind of form of idolatry? Yeah, I think hoarding, at least in Exodus, is understood as a lack of trust in God. Right? That a lack of trust that God will provide. And so, yes, I suppose a kind of idolatry. Trusting in your own work and your own resources rather than in God. Yeah?
That's intriguing. Stirring up excess, even for good purposes, it's a real temptation. You can kind of justify it.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with a pastor in a small congregation in North Dakota during the oil boom, and they had sold some mineral rights, and now this tiny head of congregation had a $3 million endowment.
Oh my gosh.
And he said it was destroying the congregation. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, I was calling because we had some mineral rights as well, and he said, get rid of them, sell them.
You know? Really? Yeah.
Don't, it's just, you know, and it was this example of, all the focus became about the endowment and this money, and it was kind of like...
And it was tearing them apart because they were arguing about how to use it or what to do with it. Wow, that's really fascinating. Thank you for that illustration. I'm going to steal that and use it next time I teach. That's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, this, I guess, you know, obviously there's poverty is a terrible thing, and... I think about a verse in Proverbs, right? And sometimes we think about Proverbs as kind of prosperity gospel, right? If you do the right thing, then you'll get blessed. But there's this particular passage, and I think that's too simplistic a reading of Proverbs. There's a particular passage that says, let me not be too rich or too poor. Because if I'm too poor, then I will be tempted to steal, and I'll dishonor the name of God. But if I'm too rich, then I will think that I've done it by my own labor, and I won't rely on God. I won't, you know, I'll stop trusting in God. I'm paraphrasing, but that's the basic sense of it. So yeah, too much can become idolatry, can become a source of great conflict.
Circling, if I could go back also to the Sabbath conversation. There's a tech, so one very popular trend in Silicon Valley is these tech companies that have unlimited vacation. So you don't have vacation, everybody gets unlimited vacation.
Okay.
But what happens in a lot of these companies is just that nobody uses it. Because there's still this pressure to perform.
Yeah.
And
I
can't remember what the company was, but I can't remember which company it was, but one of them, when they identified this challenge, basically, and drilled into it, what they realized is that everybody was looking to their manager, basically, for like their patterns and how they work.
Yeah.
And it was all the way up to the top that, you know, the CEOs weren't taking vacation. So the company made a decision very explicitly, sort of like establishing a Sabbath, that the CEOs and the board of directors or the C-suite started taking, you know, 2-3 weeks of absolute vacation where they would completely disconnect.
Uh-huh.
And then they actually started penalizing people if they didn't take a minimum amount of vacation.
Huh.
And I think that even in these scenarios, there's this pressure up. And so, like, thinking about this, like, tabernacle question, or, like, the Israelites building the tabernacle, like, all it takes is one person in, like, a fairly senior leadership position to be like, all right, you know, I'm gonna sacrifice to work this one extra day.
Yeah.
But that can just very easily establish a culture and establish a pressure throughout the entire community if you don't have enforcement.
That's an excellent example. Thank you.
Yeah.
Did you guys hear that? Okay, good. Yeah.
I'm also reminded of the start of the pandemic when people were going into Costco and other stores and just buying out.
Yes.
The toilet paper, the black beans, and the stores are saying, we have enough.
Right.
Don't worry, we have more coming.
Yeah.
You don't need to buy for 6 months.
Yeah.
And so it's that feeling of scarcity that created a sense of fear. It seems like that people just felt like, I've got to get enough for 6 months.
Yeah.
So you didn't.
Right.
You just needed enough for the next week.
Yeah. That's an excellent example too. Thank you, all of you. That's wonderful. Yeah, so this hoarding, right? There was enough toilet paper, right? But because people started having this attitude of scarcity and hoarding, then there were, fights in the aisle over toilet paper.
Yes, that ended up being a problem with my grandparents, and I think also with my husband's family as well, because they lived through the Depression.
Oh, yeah.
So for the rest of their lives, my mother would take my grandmother out to Fort Lewis, and she would get her groceries cheaper, and there was always food stuffed somewhere.
Yeah.
And we lived as frugal as we possibly could, because, oh my God, that might happen again.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's a good example. Go ahead.
There's a tech company in Seattle. It was started 7 or 8 years ago, co-founded by two brothers. And he decided, this isn't right, everybody's making $15-$20 an hour, I'm making $200,000-$300,000 CEO.
Yeah.
So he changed the whole thing, and everybody makes $70,000, including him, the CEO. It costed his brother's relationship, but I think 7 or 8 years later, this is still working at a living wage for everybody. It's a real counterexample of this.
That's great to hear. Yeah, I hadn't heard about that. That's wonderful to hear. Yeah.
Are there any peoples in the world that live by the economy of sufficiency? Because I see the extremes.
Yeah.
The desperately
poor.
And then.
Or the obscenely rich. Yeah. Yeah. Who was it? One of you told me about Elon Musk after he came back from his space travel. What did he say?
It was Jeff Bezos.
Jeff Bezos.
He came back and he said, I want to thank all the Amazon customers and workers because they paid for all of this.
Completely tone deaf. Sorry, Jeff Bezos. Yeah, you either have the desperately poor or the obscenely rich, right, who don't even know what to spend their money on. Right? I think there are people, right, there are people who live by the economy of sufficiency, I think. Or at least we strive to. That should be our goal.
There's a book called Braiding Sweetgrass.
Braiding Sweetgrass, okay.
And in there, she's an indigenous Native American biologist. So she has her elder's background in philosophy, and all of it is based on how the earth provides. You never take more than you need.
Yeah.
A lot of that whole book she weaves through there. The culture of you take what you need, someone else might need it.
Yeah.
But also the earth needs the replenishing of it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a beautiful book.
That sounds lovely. Breathing sweetly. Yeah, so there are other cultures who have known this wisdom, certainly, not just the ancient Israelites. Thank you for all of that. That was really rich. Was there one more?
I was just going to say, I've experienced some hospitality on the Hawaiian Islands, and the native Hawaiians really try to exhibit this kind of philosophy. If somebody grows something, it's always shared with all the neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
And, at some points in time, there were they didn't particularly care for the tourists because we were not very nice.
Yeah.
And very considerate. But when we, my family got off the beaten path on several occasions, we encountered some Hawaiian farmers, and a man came up to us on a beach and said, "Would you like a pineapple?" And we said, "Well, sure. You know, how much?" He says, "No, this is for the people." And he had a truckload of pineapple that needed to be given used. They were very ripe. And we said, "Oh, we'll take one." He said, "No, you have four people. You each can have a pineapple."
Wow.
So it was given, and, yeah. because we have it, we share it.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that example. Yeah, I think at our best we can do this, right? Like, I think about a lot of our churches, right, that have garden tables where you put all your extra zucchini, right, or your tomatoes, or your, right? So there's, or I think of farming communities, and unfortunately, you know, they're becoming much less and less populated, but, you know, where a farmer has an accident and all the neighbors come to help harvest the crop, right? I mean, we've all heard stories like that. So a lot of it, I think, has to do with knowing the neighbor, right? Or being intentional about knowing the neighbor and creating this, you know, community where everyone has enough and no one has too much. That's our goal. So we've talked about Sabbath as rest. We've talked about Sabbath as an act, a radical act of trust that God will provide. We've talked about Sabbath. Well, the next one I want to talk about is Sabbath as justice. This is my image of Sabbath as rest. Let's talk about Sabbath and justice, or Sabbath as justice. The first statement of the Ten Commandments is in Exodus 20. It's restated in Deuteronomy 5. So if you remember, Deuteronomy is kind of a, well, it means the second law. So it's the second giving of the law. This is right, the Israelites are right at the cusp of the Promised Land. It's not the first generation that comes out of Egypt because they've all died in the wilderness. It's 40 years later, so it's the second generation, those who were not at Mount Sinai. And so Moses gives this very long sermon in three parts in Deuteronomy to remind them of where they've come from. And he says in Deuteronomy chapter 5, he says, I'm going to read it again because it's just so beautiful. "Hear, O Israel, the statutes and ordinances that I am addressing to you today. The Lord our God made a covenant with us at Horeb. Not with our ancestors did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today." So on the face of it, that's not actually true, right? The Lord made a covenant with us at Sinai. Well, these are the children of that first generation with whom the Lord made a covenant. But Moses says, "Not with our ancestors did the Lord make this covenant, but with us who are all of us here alive today." So it's interesting because the covenant is renewed. It's not just that first generation, but it's that second generation who are on the cusp of entering the Promised Land. And it's every generation afterwards that hears these words, including us, right? "Not with our ancestors did the Lord make this covenant, but with us, who are all of us here alive today." So it's this not just renewal of the covenant, but a living out of the covenant for every generation that hears this. And then comes the Ten Commandments, or the restatement of the Ten Commandments, and it's pretty much word for word for all the commandments, except for the Sabbath commandment. So in Exodus, it says, "Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you." In Deuteronomy, it's observe or keep. There's that word shamar that we talked about, I think, yesterday or the day before. Shamar, keep. Adam is told to keep the garden, right? To till, to serve the garden, and to keep it. So here we keep the Sabbath day and keep it holy, as the Lord your God commanded you. And then it's the same commandment. But the reason is also different. So remember, in Exodus, the reason given was in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, but rested the seventh day, therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day. So in Exodus, the reason given for keeping the Sabbath is because we are made in the image of God, and God established the Sabbath. In Deuteronomy, the reason given is this: remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. So Sabbath is about rest, Sabbath is about trust, and Sabbath is also about justice. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. This is a phrase that's said over and over again, both in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt. Therefore, do not oppress your own slaves in the way that you were oppressed. That's the meaning of that phrase. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, so don't do the same thing to those who are under your authority, including your servants, including your children, including even your livestock. So Sabbath is about rest, Sabbath is about trust, and Sabbath is about justice. So I'm reminded of a story that I heard from an African biblical scholar a number of years ago now. I was at a conference, the annual conference of the Society of Biblical Literature, which is all the Bible geeks in the world who get together once a year. So this particular biblical scholar was from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and he spoke about a woman in his church who worked at an internet cafe in the city. Now, if you've ever been to a sub-Saharan African city, you know what I'm talking about, right? There's these internet cafes, these storefront small places with a few computers where you can rent time on the computer and print some things out and maybe buy a few items, like office supply items. This woman, this member of the congregation of the biblical scholars, she worked 7 days a week, 8 to 10 hours a day, week after week after week in this internet cafe. Not because she wanted to work that much, but because she knew that if she quit, there were 20 people in line behind her for this job, right? So in order to support herself and her family, she worked 7 days a week, 8 to 10 hours a day, week after week after week. So the Sabbath commandment is given not just for the head of the household or for the boss, it's given for the sake of those who have no choice not to work, right? It's given for the sake of those under the authority who have no freedom. It's given for their protection. So let's look at it again. You shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, or your male or female slave, or your ox or your donkey, or any of your livestock, or the resident alien in your towns, so that your male and female slave may rest as well as you do. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. So Sabbath is about rest, Sabbath is about trust, and Sabbath is about justice. Sabbath is also about more than human beings. Sabbath is about the land. There's Sabbath not just for human beings and animals, but there's also Sabbath for the land. So just a couple chapters after the Ten Commandments in Exodus, it says this: for 6 years you shall sow your land and gather in its yield, but the seventh year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the wild animals may eat. You shall do the same with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the seventh day you shall rest, so that your ox and your donkey may have relief, and your homeborn slave and the resident alien may be refreshed. This extension of the Sabbath commandment to the land itself is an extension also of the radical trust that the Sabbath requires. God will provide on the seventh day. God will also provide in the seventh year from the harvest of the previous 6 years and from what the land produces on its own. This sabbatical year, which provides rest for the land as well as its inhabitants, points to a holistic understanding of the relationship between humanity and the earth. Human beings, we are created as flesh and blood creatures. We're not automatons, we're not machines. We need regular rest. The earth, the land, the fertile soil itself cannot produce endlessly either. It requires a regular fallow time when it naturally regenerates itself, when plant matter decays and returns its nutrients to the soil. Otherwise, if we don't allow this kind of fallow time, the land's soil and nutrients are stripped away so that it can no longer feed its people. Now, good farmers obviously have always known this truth, right? And it's not just the Israelites, it's other cultures that have allowed this kind of fallow time. One of those good farmers is Wendell Berry. He has this long poem called The Farm, but I particularly like this part of it. It's basically advice to a young farmer. He says, where you grew corn last year, sow buckwheat, let it seed, then disk it in and grow a second crop to disk in. This is for humus and to keep out weeds. It is a Sabbath for the land, rest and enrichment, good for it, for you, for all the ones who are unborn. The land must have its Sabbath or take it when we starve. Isn't that lovely? But this idea that the land itself needs that regular time of rest to be enriched to support us.
It's also an acknowledgement that corn is a very costly crop to grow on the land.
Yeah.
Which is odd since corn is king now.
Right, corn is king now, but it strips a lot of nutrients. Yeah. Now, some people ask, well, how did this work, really? They really kept, they really didn't farm every seventh year? And we don't really know. I mean, we do know from other biblical texts, including the prophets, that the Sabbath year for the land was practiced, or at least they knew about it. They didn't always practice it. Some scholars think maybe it was a cycle, right? So this, if you had seven fields or you had three fields, right, you'd do one every year or every seventh year, right? So maybe you'd have two fields that were producing crops and one was fallow. That seems likely, right? So that you're not just completely without crops one year. But it's just a good thing to do for the soil. Yeah.
That reminded me of, we keep bees. We don't have much corn around us. I don't know if the bees like the corn, but they love buckwheat.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of reminds me that there are other creatures other than us that might benefit from that.
Yeah.
I think we're at, so the year of rest, it's called the Shemitah year, or cycle of Sabbath, is starting this fall with Rosh Hashanah. So it's an interesting time in the faith-based environmental world because we're really seeing this reemergence of the Shemitah Sabbath year in collective awareness, in new forms of practice. So that's something Earth Ministry is working on with the Jewish community across the Northwest, but it's also kind of a national reemergence that we've really been noticing.
So how is that work? So they're committing to not, to letting land lie fallow?
Yeah, so it's less in the very strict legalistic land use, but more of acknowledging this is the Shemitah year. So in our current day and age, how can we practice in our lives, in our communities, the values that come with the Sabbath of Shemitah. So values like reciprocity, generosity, rest, debt release.
Uh-huh.
So there's like a Jewish Free Loan Federation, I think it's an interesting time to be.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. Thank you. Thanks, Jess. So the Sabbath year, so Sabbath is about rest, Sabbath is about trust, Sabbath is about justice, Sabbath is about letting land lie fallow. And remember, in that commandment, of course, there's going to be volunteer plants coming up, right? Whenever you've planted potatoes or tomatoes or zucchini, God help us, it comes up. You can tell I don't love zucchini. I like little zucchini, I don't like the monster. My husband insists on saving all of it, though, instead of composting it. These volunteer plants are going to come up, and if you notice in that commandment, you allow the poor of your people and the wild animals, isn't that interesting, like the deer eating the compost up by the show, but you allow both the poor of the land and the wild animals, and presumably the foreigners, to eat what comes up on its own. So this is also justice, not just for the land, but for the poor and the foreigner. Let me end with three slides, and I promise tomorrow we'll get to Jubilee. We'll talk about Jubilee tomorrow, the Sabbath of Sabbaths. So there's Sabbath for people, a weekly Sabbath, there's Sabbath for land every 7 years. There's also a Sabbath for slaves every 7 years. Now before I talk about this, let me just talk about slavery in Israel. At least within the community itself, you know, the same word, eved, is used for both slaves and servants. Slavery in ancient Israel is not the kind of chattel slavery that we think about when we think about the terrible history of the United States. It's more of what you might call indentured servanthood. So if you had a bad crop year, if you fell ill, if you, you know, if there was drought or whatever, and you had to sell, you had to pay off debts, you could sell yourself or your children, which might be a temptation for us occasionally. I'm just kidding. You could sell yourself into slavery to pay off your debt, but it's indentured servanthood, meaning that once you worked off the debt, then you were free, right? So it's not the kind of lifelong, ethnically based slavery that we think about in the United States. If your debt was large enough, though, and you couldn't work it off, you still were free in the seventh year. You were free of debt, free and clear. So that's what this is about. If a member of your community, whether a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you and works for you for 6 years, in the seventh year you shall set that person free. And when you send a male slave out from you, a free person, you shall not send him out empty-handed. Provide liberally out of your flock, your threshing floor, and your winepress, thus giving to him some of the bounty with which the Lord your God has blessed you. Here's that phrase again. Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. For this reason I lay this command upon you today. You shall do the same with regard to your female slave. This is really interesting. So Sabbath is for people, weekly, and animals. Sabbath is for the land every seventh year. Sabbath is also for those who have fallen into debt every seventh year, both male and female. And the interesting thing too, or the beautiful thing, is that you don't just send them out empty-handed so that they fall right back into debt, right? You give them the means to support themselves. You give them crops and wine and some of the bounty and wheat. You know, you give them enough so that they can, you know, support themselves, so that they don't fall right back into debt again. This is kind of a microcosm of what the Jubilee does as well. In all of this, of course, the intent is life, is abundant life. We saw that in the creation account, where God creates space and then inhabits it with life or fills it with life. We see it in the Sabbath commandment as well, which talks about justice, about rest, about restraint, about saying enough, right? That's the beauty of Sabbath. That's the profound nature of Sabbath. It's the ability to say enough, right? Enough grasping for things, enough working endlessly, enough, you know, exploitation of the land. Just stop, right? And that's so hard for our society to say, right? Enough, I have enough. I have enough so that I can share, right? So that we all have enough. I want to mention two other laws, and we'll end with this, that also reflect this concern for life. And this first one is going to seem a little strange to you. This is a law about warfare in Deuteronomy 20. If you besiege a town for a long time, making war against it in order to take it, you must not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them. Although you may take food from them, you must not cut them down. Are trees in the field human beings that they should come under siege from you? So this may seem strange to us because it's talking about laying siege to a town, right? It's talking about war. How is this about life? Well, frankly, war is just kind of a normal part of life in the ancient Near East, not just for Israel, but for its the neighboring nations. But this is another kind of restraint, another kind of boundary put on human striving in Deuteronomy. You should know the background of this. The Assyrians, the Assyrian Empire and the Babylonian Empire, but particularly the Assyrian Empire, the one that was responsible for the 10 lost tribes, right, for destroying the northern land of Israel. The Assyrians were notorious for when they took a town, they would salt the fields around it. And they would cut down all the trees, including olive trees that take years and years and years to start bearing, can live to be 1,000 or 2,000 years old. They cut down the olive trees and the fig trees and the pomegranate trees, you know. And they'd salt the fields so that when eventually the war was over, when people could settle again in the town, well, they couldn't because there was no land to support them. So the Israelites are told, you don't act that way, right? You don't do that. Yes, you can besiege a town if you have, you know, if you have to, but you keep the means for life in that town and around that town. You allow life to continue. In the same way, this kind of odd law, but one that's really beautiful too. If you come on a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground with fledglings or eggs, with the mother sitting on the fledglings or on the eggs, you shall not take the mother with the young. Let the mother go, taking only the young for yourself, in order that it may go well with you and you may live long. Isn't that lovely too? Like, you can eat eggs, right? They're not vegan, they're not vegetarian. But leave the mother alone so that life can continue, right? Don't take the mother hen or the mother bird along with its young or with the eggs. Let the mother alone so that life continues. So there's this, I know this sounds odd sometimes because there are some fierce and harsh laws in the Old Testament, but there are also these laws and this attitude, this culture that says life, creation is good. And life is good, and life needs to continue. Again, God doesn't create things just as a one-off thing. God instills within creation itself and within these laws, like the law of the Sabbath, the impulse, the theme that life must continue, and life abundant. All right, so tomorrow, this is a word cloud of Leviticus. We're going to get into Leviticus and talk about Jubilee, and we're going to talk about the continuing voice of Jubilee, what it has inspired, and contrast it with some of our own current culture's practices. So I'm happy to talk afterwards. I know I've come up against my time, so I won't ask for questions. But thank you for your attention, and have a good rest of your day.